I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Friday, September 18th. Ahead of the November election, the Trump administration is touting peacemaking deals these last 2 weeks. There are even a couple of people in Norway with the authority to do so, apparently, who have nominated him for the Nobel Peace Prize. First, the president gathered the leaders of the Balkan neighbors Kosovo and Serbia to broker a supposed economic deal. And this week, Trump announced the dawn of a new Middle East, as he put it, after a signing ceremony between Israel, the United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain, in which the Gulf states became just the third and fourth Arab countries ever to recognize Israel. There is much commentary now on what's real here and what's less than meets the eye. Joining me now to talk about the latest Trump administration attempts at peacemaking initiatives around the world and what, if anything, their impact might be is Ishan Tharoor, Washington Post columnist and author of Today's Worldview, the Post's International Affairs newsletter. Ishan, thanks for doing this. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Can you begin with some context about Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates? These are not countries that most Americans hear about much. They are Sunni Gulf states worried about aggression by Shiite Iran. Saudi Arabia is the biggest of those states. What's the background and the context there?
Well, as you said, these are relatively small countries, Persian Gulf states. They have, of course, no democracy. These are kingdoms that are dominated by specific royal families. They represent a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of the population of Arabs in the world. They represent an even smaller fraction of a fraction of a fraction of the population of Muslims in the world. But they have, because of already longstanding clandestine ties and areas of cooperation with Israel, become these two states to begin this process that the Trump administration hopes will expand, where Arab states in the region begin normalizing their relations with Israel. The UAE already has a sophisticated set of contacts with Israel. Bahrain essentially does what Saudi Arabia tells it to do, which is why its inclusion in this process that was, you know, formalized on Tuesday was significant. But as far as peace, and the reason to be skeptical of all this, especially given that we're plunged in an election cycle right now, is the framing of this has been very conspicuous. The Trump administration has branded this very grandiosely, the Abraham Accords, as if it's some great meeting of religions and peoples. It is neither that, those. It's hailed it as a kind of unprecedented, inconceivable feat that previous administrations would never have accomplished. But what it actually does is simply formalize the realities as they were in the first place. And when we're talking about peace, which is, of course, how this has been built, what peace are we talking about in the region? There are still very ruinous civil wars taking place in Syria, in Yemen, in Libya. Wars, of course, that the UAE has an invested role in as a proxy participant. And then, of course, we're not talking about the Palestinians. The Palestinians don't even come up once, really, in any of the formal texts surrounding this agreement. So the idea that this is some major moment, historic moment for peace, is also something to be skeptical about.
But what does either side get concretely from the deal? They must get something, but you and many others have framed it as kind of acknowledging peaceful relations that already existed because of mutual interests regarding Iran between Bahrain and the UAE and Israel. So what does either side get concretely from signing this formal recognition agreement?
Well, the UAE, certainly the most concrete thing the UAE has emerged with this week is commitments from the United States to sell F-35 fighter planes, a new set of weaponized drones. The arms sales are the big plank of this, and this is another irony of a peace agreement, is that the greatest consequence of it is commitment to weapon sales. That's one of the main things the UAE gets out of it. I think this is very much in the interest of the UAE and the interest of Bahrain to a lesser extent, because they do see Israel as a useful ally in the region. They see Israel as both a hedge against Iran, which is a mutual sort of nemesis for both countries, but also as a hedge against the possibility of a future American administration further disentangling itself from the region. Israel and the Emiratis both fear a context where the U.S. is less engaged in the Middle East, is less willing to put its thumb on the scale in terms in regional geopolitics the way the Trump administration has. And they see these areas of deepening cooperation as an important bulwark for them and their national security interests going forward.
I guess against Iran in particular, and on the pro side of this, Madeleine Albright, for example, the former Democratic Secretary of State, wrote on Politico, the UAE's historic decision reflects its heightened alarm at Iran's disruptive activity throughout the region. A growing alignment between Israel and the Gulf states could do much to deter future Iranian adventurism and possibly lead to an eventual reduction in tensions. Any thought about that or those who see it that way?
That is a potential, that is the rosy, the potentially rosy outcome for strategists here in Washington. I think, of course, it's important to recognize and say up front that when states decide to improve ties and formalize dialogue, that's generally a good thing, and one shouldn't necessarily be pessimistic about it. Where this takes geopolitics in the region, that's an open debate, and others would counter that this kind of clear bulwark being created between the Sunni Gulf states and Israel may only speed a certain kind of zero-sum polarization in the region. You're seeing, as on the other side of this, countries like Iran, countries like Turkey, feel increasingly encircled, and it could lead to, contrary to what the Secretary of State says, a growing set of tensions and a growing set of disputes and conflicts that take higher stakes in the years to come.
There's, of course, the question of the Palestinians here, and many Palestinians feel betrayed by any Arab country that would make a peace agreement with Israel without the Palestinian right to self-determination being a part of that. There's a counter-argument by the conservative New York Times columnist Brett Stevens. As the Times puts it, Palestinian leaders have rebuked Bahrain and the UAE for forfeiting what they view as a key source of leverage against Israel in the push to end its occupation of the West Bank and blockade of Gaza. But Stevens argues that decades of failure to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict have revealed the futility of that strategy. Reversing its order by normalizing Arab-Israeli ties first, he says, could be what finally creates the conditions for Palestinian statehood. Now, I'm not sure exactly where the leverage would come from if they've already normalized with Israel, but it's an interesting view on it because it's true, it was supposed to be that normalizing relations with the Palestinians or solving that conflict and, you know, giving them a state in the context of a peace deal with them would be the condition for Arab countries coming to a more permanent peace with Israel from their standpoint. The reverse order is what Brett Stevens assigns as an alternative pathway to self-determination for the Palestinians if Israel and the Arab neighbors have better relations.
And this is indeed the line from the Trump administration as well, from Netanyahu's government, which has put forward this very simple and powerful message that they are exchanging peace for peace, no longer land for peace. And yes, what Bahrain and the UAE did was essentially undermine almost two decades of longstanding Arab League policy, which was they would tether their future normalization of relations with Israel to the ending of or lifting of Israeli occupation on Palestinians and Palestinian territories. By doing this, they're scrapping that kind of commitment, and we may see other Arab states say, okay, we're going to follow suit as well. Now, how this leads to a Palestinian state is completely, we have no idea, and there's no real good answer to it. What we have seen in the last two decades since these Arab countries made these commitments was that, by and large, the Arab countries have not shown Israel that they really want to muster leverage and really push for the kinds of things they say they do when they talk about ending the occupation and helping Palestine achieve a state. And so the Palestinians have their own long narrative now of Arab betrayal. This is just the latest episode of that narrative of Arab betrayal. And we may eventually see what emerges from this is that Palestinians now may recognize that this process that they have been yoked to, that the Arab states have formally agreed to, where they emerge with this kind of technocratic separate state, is a doomed and an impossible process. And the focus may now turn to the realities on the ground and the question of Palestinian rights. They live as second-class citizens under occupation, under curfews, subject to military law. And the focus may now turn to something a bit uncomfortable, and this is something that people don't want to really see here in Washington. And in Israel, it's also quite uncomfortable as well, is that when you give up the ghost of a Palestinian state, what are you left with? And that will be questions of Palestinian rights and equal rights in a decidedly undemocratic context.
And there are two competing visions, one might say, of a one-state solution there, which is kind of beyond the scope of this segment to get into. But sure. There's the one that does include kind of permanent second-class status of Palestinians, where they have some kind of internal autonomy within their areas to some degree, but Israel still rules the territories and they can't vote equally in national elections and things like that. The other is to make it a Western democracy, a single state like the United States, where everybody gets a vote. That, of course, would make it not a Jewish state in the sense of guaranteed political power. So that obviously is controversial from that side. But there are those two competing visions of what a one-state solution might be if the two-state solution has, in fact, collapsed. Staying in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia would be the big prize there among those Gulf Sunni states that fear Iran, but they have not come on board. And they have a long-standing peace proposal with respect to Israel that includes the Palestinians. What's Saudi Arabia's role in this scenario?
Well, the Saudi leadership, and especially Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, are very inclined towards a degree of normalization with Israel. We know for a fact that the Crown Prince is fascinated by the Israeli tech sector. He wants to deepen those ties economically. He wants to bring Israeli know-how to as part of his regeneration of the Saudi economy. And he's deeply uninterested in the Palestinian plight. And this is true more broadly for many of the political elites throughout the Middle East. They're tired of having to pay lip service to the Palestinian cause and are very eager to move on and make peace with Israel and also hedge against Iran. And that those are their priorities now. The difference for Saudi Arabia compared to, say, Bahrain and the Middle East is that Saudi Arabia actually has a significant population. It's obviously an autocratic monarchical state, but public opinion there does exist. And there would be a bulk of the population that would feel a bit unnerved if their rulers, who are the custodians of the holy sites, who cast themselves as great defenders of the region, of the religion, of Arabs, turn their back so definitively on the Palestinians in the ways that the UAE and the Bahrainis have. So they're in a more delicate situation, and that's why Bahrain doing it, and then potentially a country like Sudan or even a kingdom as far away as Morocco following suit, is a safer step for them than for them plunging into this right now.
Has the international backlash against the Crown Prince for the Khashoggi killing, Washington Post journalist, my very belated condolences, had any effect on Saudi Arabia's role, all the backlash against Crown Prince MBS, had any effect on Saudi Arabia's role or bargaining clout in the bigger scheme of things with Israel or Iran or the United States?
From as far as we know, and frankly, not really. I think it was awkward for the Crown Prince in particular in terms of a few months before the events that led to my colleague Jamal Khashoggi's killing, the Crown Prince went on this great grand tour of Western capitals. He came to D.C. He actually visited the offices of the Post. He swanned around Silicon Valley and went elsewhere as well in Europe. And he was really excited about his new role as this Western-facing, if not liberalizing, but modernizing figure for the Middle East. Then that all fell apart after it became clear, and U.S. intelligence agencies believe that he was directly involved in this plot that led to the gruesome killing of a Saudi dissident journalist. So for him personally, it's been a bit of an issue, but for Saudi Arabia's place in the region, its ties to the United States, they've not taken that much of a hit because they've been mostly shielded by President Trump, who has stalled bipartisan legislation that would seek to punish Saudi Arabia, has kept up arms sales and preserved and protected arms sales to the Middle East, because that really is President Trump's major interest when it comes to his engagement there. And so they have not taken that much of a hit.
Ari in Somerset, you're on WNYC with Ishan Tharoor from The Washington Post. Hello, Ari.
Yes, good morning. First of all, I wanted to say that using the word peace is misleading. Peace you make with country that you have a physical contact with. Israel never had physical contact or any kind of violent war. Contact with Bahrain or United Emirates. No war with Bahrain or United Emirates. This is more like a striking relationship that exists for 30 years. The idea that Netanyahu and Kushner and some other people think that they can have a peace with other Arab world, mostly in the Gulf, that have need for American support and protection, but not having a peace with the Palestinian is wrong to begin with, because our neighbors are the Palestinian. And I'm saying our neighbor because I was born and raised and serve in the Israeli army. Our neighbors are the Palestinian. So you go make a peace with a country, you know, 1,000 miles away, and thinking that you're going to ban the people that you really need to make peace with. It's all about the election. It's all about Netanyahu being in trouble, the way he ran the country during the corona, President Trump with his failure in running the country during the corona. It's all about the timing is unbelievable. And the word peace is just so misleading, because these two leaders need to divert the attention from their failure. And they call this a peace. It's not a peace, because we never had a war with Bahrain, and we have relationship with them since the Oslo Agreement. And there's always commerce and always business relationship with Israel company and United Emirates. If you really want to make a peace, go ahead and make peace with the people you have a conflict with the Palestinian. That's my comment.
Ari, thank you very much for your call. Avi in Park Slope, you're on WNYC. Avi, thanks a lot for calling in.
Okay, thank you very much. Very exciting discussions. It's a very exciting time. I'm a little bit surprised by the previous comments. I have a couple of comments to make. Number one, we have a two-state solution. The two-state solution that was signed by Faisal and Weizmann basically welcomed Jews to come to the area and to build the area. What is happening today is a tectonic shift in the Middle East. For the first time, the Arab boycott was canceled. For the first time, we have a peace agreement. It is a peace agreement between an Arab country, which is blessed by the majority of Arab countries, intellectuals. One has to listen to bloggers from Saudi Arabia. One has to listen to bloggers from the Emirates. This is for the first time a real peace between people. The peace with Egypt and Jordan is like a long-term hudna. We had a very cold peace. We never had any visits from Jordanians or Egyptians in Israel. We had at the beginning tourists to Egypt. My parents went to Egypt to see this beautiful country. But what we have today is basically a divorce from Turkey and from Iran. The Arab world decided that the Palestinians have held a veto on relationship, and because of it, not only on relationship with Israel, but on the progress of the Middle East. We have millions and millions of bright Arab young people that have no jobs. You have millions and millions of people in poverty. And I see the Palestinian issue as one of the major problems in the Middle East. The Palestinians said no since the Peel Committee. Since 1936, they said no. They said no to everything. Mubarak shouted at Arafat, "You are a dog, sign it." And he didn't sign it in Camp David. Olmert gave them the Western Wall and agreed to 200,000 refugees back. And they didn't sign it. Abu Mazen didn't even come back with a counteroffer. So the Arabs understand today that the Palestinians are the problem, and they have to detach themselves from this problem. And I believe, I'm a fifth-generation Israeli, I strongly believe that when the Arab countries do that, the Palestinians will come to the table, and they will have to negotiate on a reasonable deal. And what is the deal going to be? It's up to the Palestinians and the Israelis, and I think the Trump administration, with all the criticism that you might have on the Trump administration, they have done something that nobody else could do before. And it basically exposes the mistakes of the Obama administration, that you cannot have peace without the Palestinians. On the contrary, you will have peace with the Palestinians when the Arab world comes around.
And Avi, I'm going to leave it there. I really appreciate your thoughts. And it's been very interesting, Ishan, to hear these two competing perspectives from two Israeli expats.
Yes, absolutely. Both Avi and Ari, I mean, these are very interesting points. And I think to combine what they're saying it's true that disagreement is not really about the Palestinians. It's about a shifting reality in the region where I wouldn't say a majority of Arabs, but certainly a segment of the Arab political elites in the region have found plenty of common cause with Israel and would like to deepen their alliances there. And they are tired of being hamstrung to what they see as a kind of dead-end process surrounding the Palestinians. So this is indeed about sidelining the Palestinian issue. And Israel has rather successfully, over the last couple of decades, protected itself from really suffering any consequences of undermining. They have expanded settlements. They've expanded their zones of control in the West Bank. They've essentially made a viable Palestinian state incredibly difficult. And they've paid no political cost for it because the Arab states, beyond issuing statements, are not interested in extending any leverage to help the Palestinians. So what we've seen in the last week and what we've seen over the last couple of years with the Trump administration is a confirmation of a shifting reality, and that's the one we're in right now.
Ishan Tharoor, Washington Post columnist and author of Today's Worldview, the Post's international affairs newsletter. Thanks so much for coming on.
My pleasure, as always.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.